And welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm film critic Debbie Elias, creator and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers, the shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, editors, sound mixers, composers, you name it, and I'm talking to them. We're going to be doing some talking today, but first, you know, happy Veterans Day, and to all the veterans out there, of which there are many that I know listen to the show, thank you for your service. You have my undying respect. One of my oldest friends is a former Marine. I've known him over 50 years. My father was in the Army. My maternal grandfather was in World War I as part of Baker Company behind enemy lines in France. And then he ran the brig at Fort Benning for many years. So interesting. But in honor of Veterans Day, we've got a film that is perfect for today. The Last Rifleman, starring Pierce Brosnan, directed by Terry Lone. It's inspired by a true story, based on the UK vet Bernard Jordan. And I'll get into the explanation in a second, but I just want to also mention that at the midpoint of the show, we have a returning guest. Actor, writer, Colin Cunningham is back with us. It's been a few years, but he's going to be here today talking about his latest film. It's a genre meld, slasher, serial killer, horror, lots of bloodshed, bit of a mystery happening in there. Colin's going to be joining me at the midpoint of the show, and I'm so excited because I also get to ask him about Horizon Chapter 1, which he is in. So, we may have lost Kevin Costner in Yellowstone, which, by the way, folks, I hope you all saw the season 5 part 2 premiere last night on Paramount Network. To die for, literally and figuratively. What a way to open and to address the issue of no more Kevin Costner. Taylor Sheridan wasted no time in putting that to bed, putting it to rest. But of course, this opens up a whole new dynamic and twists and turns for the remainder of the series. And there is scuttlebutt of a season 6. I do hope that we get a season 6 with Cole Hauser and Kelly Reilly and Luke Grimes leading the charge and leading the Yellowstone Ranch forward. But we'll find out. For right now, I'm chomping at the bit now for next Sunday and the next episode. Fantastic. And if you haven't seen it, I think Paramount Network is running it already. But check that out. You don't want to miss Yellowstone winding down. And now back to... you're going to hear my interview, my exclusive interview with director Terry Lone talking about The Last Rifleman. As I said, it's written by Kevin Fitzpatrick. It's loosely based on the story of a World War II veteran, Bernard Jordan. And in The Last Rifleman, Pierce Brosnan plays Artie Crawford, essentially who would be the Bernard Jordan character. He's living in an old age home in Northern Ireland. His wife has just died, and the 75th anniversary of D-Day landings is approaching rapidly, and he wants to escape from the nursing home, and he does, and he embarks on a journey to France to pay his final respects and to hopefully see some of his old comrades. And one of the running jokes in here, and having Pierce Brosnan star as Artie Crawford is so key. Number one, the makeup job that makes him look 92 3/4 years old is phenomenal. And we all know Pierce is going to look great at 92 3/4 or 102 3/4. So makeup had a lot, you know. You can't make Pierce Brosnan ever look ugly. Let's face it. So one of the running jokes is, and having Pierce, who can bring in the emotional gravitas, but also add his Irish wit and humor. One of the continuing jokes in the film is that when people say, "Oh, he's 92 years old," and he goes, "92 3/4." And he emphasizes that and makes a big deal about that. But what is so, it's so moving. Number one, watching this story unfold, watching a man and everything that he will go through, an expired passport and the kindness of others, and him telling the stories about World War II and his best friend, Charlie, and others in his brigade with him as he makes his way to France for the 75th D-Day celebrations. And as many of you should know, this year marked the 80th anniversary of D-Day. But an exquisite, exquisite film. Terry, so invested, so prepared in bringing this film to life. So much thought. Cinematographer is Mark McCauley, who does a beautiful job with a light visual tone, contrasting that with battle sequences. John Walters edits beautifully. Stephen Warbeck's score is stunning. And I have long been an admirer of Stephen Warbeck as a composer, going back to the days of Billy Elliot and Captain Corelli's Mandolin. Captain Corelli is the first time I really took note of Stephen's work as a composer and how it's integrated into the films that he does choose to compose for. So much of this is shot on location. There are some poignant scenes that I warn you, when you see the film, and it is in theaters, it's also on VOD and streaming, have tissues at the ready. You're going to need them when you get into the third act of this film. And a key element of this is one of John Amos's final performances. There are a couple more films he was scheduled to do, some were in pre-production. I don't think that any of that will ever come to fruition. So this could end up being the final screen performance of John Amos, who there's a scene between he and Pierce Brosnan and their two characters that are just, yeah, that's a tissue scene too. But without any further ado, take a listen to my exclusive interview with director Terry Lone talking about the emotionally exquisite The Last Rifleman.
Hello, hello, Terry. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. I'm feeling the unease in the world, having that everything seems to have changed in the last 24 hours. But I'm coping.
It'll all even out eventually.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
It always does.
It felt like it was never going to end, whatever the outcome.
I have great confidence things will even out, Terry. Especially when you see a film like The Last Rifleman. And you see the emotion that a 92-year-old man brings to the table with his convictions and how life has gone on for him, no matter what has happened through the past 90 years. And I think that's a really important message that people can learn something from watching this film at this particular juncture in time. You have done an amazing job with this film, Terry. It is so beautiful.
Thank you. But you know, there was a serious team of hardworking people. I can take a little bit of the credit for getting a great bunch of people together.
You sure did, in front of and behind the camera. It's a very poignant film, not only because of the subject matter and the fact that this spoke about the 75th D-Day. And, of course, we just had honored the 80th D-Day earlier this year. But you see John Amos. This is essentially one of the last times we'll see him on screen.
But yeah, I mean, we were so lucky to get John, and he flew halfway around the world to be with us, and he gave us everything. He was a joy to have on set, and I think it's on screen now. You'll see that the connection between Pierce and John as Artie and Lincoln. That there's something magical there. It was like two titans gently listening and experiencing each other's pain and sharing a bond, sharing a common experience. I was so pleased that it worked out so beautifully. Because I think that scene is almost the heart of the film.
I was tearing up. I had tissues at the ready. So I was using them a lot in this film, Terry. But you mentioned something very important, listening. And we also see that in the bus scene with Jürgen Prochnow and Pierce. And watching Friedrich and Artie. And I personally witnessed a lot of that in my own family because my entire family on my dad's side, but for my grandparents and him, lived in Germany, grew up in Germany, and many of them fought for the Nazis. And on my mother's side, my grandfather was in the army stationed out of Fort Benning and an ally. So for me, anytime I see sequences and scenes like that, it's very, very emotional. And those two do such a beautiful job, and to see the change in attitude that Artie has, that both of them have, actually. And then that the little wave, and just absolutely beautifully done. It all goes to the listening aspect of this film, the observational and the listening aspect, to want to hear the other side, to want to hear everyone's stories. And this is where your cinematographer, Mark McCauley's work, is so beautiful, Terry. So beautiful. You've got close-ups that are show the pain in the eyes, the sorrow, the surprise went through the kindness of strangers helping Artie. It's so exquisitely shot. Your visual grammar is a joy. What were your conversations with Mark like to develop the visual grammar that you have, and to keep the film visually, tonally light?
Well, I think to keep the film, the balance of the film, was I started with the script, working with Kevin, the writer, and we knew that if we had 100 minutes of Artie's pain and difficulty in his past life and the secret he was carrying, that would be a hard journey for the audience, so we were very careful to balance it with returning to other characters, little bits of lightness, bits of levity to create a balance, because I think it's very important to sometimes let the audience breathe a moment before we hit them with another challenging encounter. But cinematographically, we were very focused on making sure that it was intimate. Mm-hmm. Even back, you know, in the initial scenes, the flashback scenes to the day after D-Day, 1944, we wanted to make sure that we were with the characters, with their emotional response, their reaction to the things that were happening. It wasn't about showing, you know, a drone shot of 500 soldiers and tanks. It was about the experience, how those people felt. And I think it's the same thing with Artie in the present day, effectively. We wanted to make sure that we were with him all the way. Mm-hmm. So we didn't focus on big, wide vistas, and we really wanted to be with him because, definitely there's so much of the time when Artie is just listening and absorbing, and he's been quiet for many, many years.
Yeah.
He's very, very careful about what he gives away and what he shares with people.
Mm-hmm.
But as he gradually opens up over the day and a half of his road trip, I think we see into his heart, and we see the pain that he's been carrying, and I guess we hopefully experience the redemption and the freedom when the story comes to its conclusion.
Oh, you absolutely achieve that, Terry. Absolutely, 1,000%. Your end scene, and not to give anything away, that will move the coldest heart. It is glorious. And it is truly something that every veteran of World War II, World War I, Korea, I mean, of any war, they deserve something like this.
One of the things that I've, with research, realizing that so many young men end up in combat, and they're not there for save the world from, you know, for democracy, or they're there for their brothers beside them, for their mates, the people that they knew at school, the people that they've trained with. They're there to look after each other, and it's that intimate and personal. So when we start talking about the bigger picture, it becomes less less, I guess it's less easy to relate to. Mm-hmm. When you're with these individuals, I think it's, yeah, that's an important message, is that every single casualty of war was a human being with a life. And that's something that we can never forget.
Your visuals, the imagery speaks so loudly, especially in that third act, walking through the memorial cemetery in France. That just, what I love what you did there is it is still, it is quiet. You have no score. You have no dialogue for a few moments there. And we are in that stillness with Artie. And then slowly you introduce the sound of chirping little birds. And it's so exquisitely thought out and assembled, Terry. Truly, it's a magical moment, quite honestly.
But it's beautiful whenever people notice little things, because we spend a lot of time with our sound design, too, because sound is such an emotional trigger, and mostly if you do little things like that, it can hopefully mean so much if it's pitched just nice and gently. So it's great to hear that you notice those things as an audience member. That's really rewarding.
I loved that. And of course, your sound is also very important in your flashbacks, most notably the D-Day, most notably the battle sequences, because there you shift your tonal, your visual tonal bandwidth shifts, your color palette shifts for those flashbacks. You didn't go sepia. You've got kind of a greenish tone almost that I'm seeing and feeling that kind of just melds into, you know, the uniforms, the greenish brown, but the sound we hear, it is so close. We are immersed in it. And this is, again, where you've got the camera in close for the intimacy of Charlie and Artie and what's happening. How difficult was that to put together those sequences with the young Charlie, the young Artie in those battle moments?
With younger actors, they will do anything you ask. Older actors have their own opinions, but the younger ones will just go for it. And, I mean, we were lucky enough to find young James Keating, a relatively unknown actor who was, I thought, a perfect match for a young Pierce Brosnan.
Mm-hmm.
With his beautiful eyes. He only has one line of dialogue, but that face could break hearts. I think that all the extras, again, we were trying so hard to make it an intimate experience that it wasn't Saving Private Ryan. We didn't have the scope to do that, so we wanted to keep it compact. And the shock of how things break out, I think, is very important through the sound and through the music. And when we pull the music away, because I think Stephen Warbeck deserves great praise, the composer, he did a beautiful job.
Yes, 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 yes. I love Stephen Warbeck and his scoring. First really fell in love with his work on Captain Corelli's Mandolin decades ago. His score here is so lovely. And for much of the film, it has a slight, almost a lilting, like an Irish lilt, undertone to it. So we get a little bit of whimsy and some of the fun that happens. The little moments of Artie with the kids in the car and Artie in the RV. And we hear that come through in the music, but it's very personal, and it fits Artie. The music fits Artie and his life. So I'm curious what were your conversations with Stephen like for what you wanted musically?
Well, the great thing was I sent Stephen the script at an early stage, and he fell in love with it, as everybody did that we brought it to. And I'd worked with Stephen before on my first film, Mickey Bo and Me, back in 2004. So we had a great rapport. And the great thing with music is Stephen would just send some ideas, some little riffs on the piano, and we would talk about what was right, what was wrong. But there was an intimacy, I think, was the thing that we talked about a lot. And the great thing is that I think I just have enough of a musical language to try and explain what I'm looking for, and Stephen seems to have a telepathic genius because it'll just come straight back and break my heart.
Well, it definitely was breaking my heart. That, for all the moments when you don't have dialogue and it's observational and we are getting inside Artie's head, just the imagery and the music just is a perfect meld, Terry. It's really beautifully done. The film actually moves by very quickly. For me, I couldn't believe it was over when it was over. And much of that is due to being so invested in the character of Artie. But I'm curious about how difficult or challenging the editing process was on this one, working with your editor, John Walters, to find this balance between intimacy and solitude and engaging with others, or inching in to engage with others, as Artie was doing. How challenging was finding that balance?
Yes, absolutely. I think, I mean, you mentioned about it being over quite quickly. I don't think too many of us leave the cinema these days and say, that film was far too short. and we were quite ruthless in making sure that each miniature episode was as tight as it could be. You know, so we did shrink some scenes down. The scene with Jürgen on the bus was a lot longer and was beautiful on the page, but when you get people like Pierce and Jürgen giving those performances, that you can strip away a line here and a line there, and their faces just tell us so much. So it was a joy to edit. It really, really was. And I guess also because, as a low-budget independent movie, we didn't have time to shoot a lot. We had to be very careful with our coverage, plan in advance. So we, you know, there was very little waste.
Everything is so well contained, and yet we feel the scope of Artie's travel from the nursing home and across the channel to get to France. And we feel the time, and we feel that scope. It's not like it's next door. You are on a ship and you're going across ocean.
Yeah, that's very important. But of course, we all know that in road movies, there are many tricks
yes.
in the trade. But we still had to make sure that we went to Dublin to get the correct train station to make sure, because otherwise the whole Irish audience would laugh if it was a fake.
They would hate you, Terry.
I know. Well, like, that's the thing. I mean, you jump into a taxi cab in Dublin and you find the conversation begins, and then you go, okay, that was wrong. What are you doing, man? So, yeah, we have to be very careful of that. And yes, our last week of filming was in France. We knew, out of respect for all of those fallen soldiers, we couldn't create a fake cemetery in Ireland or anything like that. We had to go to the cemetery where his regiment are all buried. So it was a very solemn experience for all of us in that cemetery on those days. It really was. It was very, very moving indeed.
This is loosely based on veteran Bernard Jordan's true story. And obviously there's a lot of liberty taken with his true story to make this cinematic and engaging. But I'm curious, for you as a filmmaker, what kind of burden does that put on you when you are actually telling or inspired by the story of a person, a living person or a now deceased person, especially in this kind of context, with the global impact of World War II?
Well, I think the great thing, when the script came to me from Kevin Jackson, he had already been inspired by Bernard Jordan's story, but also by a documentary made by a local company here in Belfast called We Fought on D-Day, where they interviewed veterans, local guys, all in their 70s. But this is a wonderful documentary. And looking at that, to set the story in Ireland, to rename the character, gave us the freedom to make it cinematic, because we really wanted to make sure that it was inspired by those events, but we weren't telling his story. And also, anybody who's a member of the, you know, the British Army, mm-hmm. Irish, has a whole different context, that there's a lot of inner conflict and cultural conflict that would take me hours to really explain. But it gave it an extra edge. And I think it also, going from the top of Ireland all the way down through Ireland over to France, is a much longer, more precarious journey for a 92-and-three-quarter-year-old man.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that, rather than the south of England and jumping across the channel that way, is all a little bit easy. We wanted to make sure that it was difficult, but not ridiculously hard. So we had to put that distance between him and his goal. And I think that ultimately, you know, once I started to see Pierce's face as Artie on the monitor, He just created this character that blew us all away.
I can't imagine anybody but Pierce in this role. I really can't.
The great thing is that I haven't seen him play a role like this before, and I think it's a wonderful surprise. And I know earlier this year, Pierce was nominated for one of the Irish Academy Awards for Best Actor for this film. And I know it meant a lot to him, as you know, the Irish Academy playing an Irish character, nominating Pierce, it meant a great deal. And I think it is so deserved, because it is. I think it's a revelation. It's such a sensitive performance, so subtle and so very real. And particularly because Pierce took a long time, every morning, of course, in prosthetics.
Mm-hmm.
So most days we filmed, I didn't see Pierce Brosnan. I only met Artie as he walked on the set.
Wow.
So, and I got very used to that, and the crew got very used to that. And maybe 2 or 3 days out of the 6 weeks of filming did I meet Pierce out of costume. So, yes, I got to know Artie very well. And then, thankfully, I had known Pierce before the shoot. We'd been trying to work together to find the right project for many years. And it was so good the way it happened. It was still in the crazy world of COVID, and half of our crew got COVID as we were filming.
Oh, Pierce, no.
Bulletproof when it comes to that kind of thing. And he was fit and healthy throughout, thank the good Lord.
Was there anyone else that you might have considered or thought about for the role of Artie besides Pierce?
Well, I think it's tricky because, well, the great thing was when I sent him the script, I sent it to him on a Friday, and he's in Malibu and I'm in Ireland, so he received it probably Saturday morning, and Sunday afternoon he phoned me and said, "Let's do this, Terry, let's do it." And that was all I needed, because I think for Pierce it wasn't another, you know, put a gun in his hand and be sexy and funny and all those things that he can do so well. It was something he had. It was a challenge, and I know he embraced that, and it excited him, and there was no risk because he was, I think, and is on screen spectacular.
Absolutely. So now, what did you, having now made this film, you know, and it is such an emotional film, and it says so much, it speaks so much about kindness, about telling the stories of history. As each of these people that Artie meets on his journey, they learn about his story and why he's making this trek. And so much of that has been lost over the years. Those stories of World War II, World War I, Korea, they haven't been told, they haven't been passed down. Because I think this might inspire people to listen and to tell more stories. What did you as a filmmaker take away from making The Last Rifleman?
What I took away from it was that I think that if you can craft a story that has a lot of truth and a lot of honesty in it, with enough research, because Kevin and I and the designer, and we all researched the thing like crazy to make sure that it was accurate, that I think that if you can tell a story that is emotionally open and suppose emotionally, if there's a connection there, I think then you can get across a message without banging it home in a clumsy way. You can make people, if you can make people feel things that they might not have expected, and then perhaps go and watch a documentary where you see veterans being interviewed, and to educate ourselves more, because I think I grew up watching so many movies about the Second World War,
mm-hmm.
but they were effectively adventure movies. They weren't too far away from Indiana Jones in regard to all the good guys doing this and all the bad guys getting, you know, shot far too easily. But then as into adult life, I start to see films, and of course, Saving Private Ryan was a landmark moment that changed, I think, so many people's perspective. But I think we're now very, very a sophisticated audience. And we can't fall for any kind of jingoistic, kind of hackneyed nonsense. So I think that, what I've taken away is that if you can find a human story, then people will want to listen.
Well, this is an extremely human story and exquisitely told, Terry. Are you working on anything else now, or just getting The Last Rifleman out into the world?
I'm always thinking about the next project. Because we finished the post-production on this over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a number of different things, spinning plates, as we say, a number of different possibilities, some very interesting things. So it's a tricky time for independent film these days.
It sure is.
But it's never been easy. So to friends of mine who always ask, how do you keep going in between these projects? I said, well, you don't give up. If you give up, you fail. So I now have some really interesting scripts have come my way. So it's very exciting. And the joy of having worked with Pierce and having worked with Kieran Hines in my previous movie,
mm-hmm.
And Julian Walters, you know, it's great. It helps when other actors are willing to take a risk to work with me as a first-time director in their world. So it's easier now. It's a little easier now to talk to the actors that you want to work with. And when they can see the work that has come before, it makes all those things maybe a tiny little bit easier. But looking forward to getting back behind the camera again.
I can't wait to see what you bring us next, Terry. The Last Rifleman, it is exquisite. Thank you so much. This has been so lovely getting to chat with you this morning. Or this afternoon. It's afternoon.
It's evening
for you.
It's nearly bedtime.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, it's lunchtime for me. Bedtime for you. Thank you so much, Terry. This has just been wonderful. And I hope we get to chat again in the future.
I hope so. After my next movie, come find me.
I will hunt you down. I will. I promise. I'll hunt you down. Thanks so much, Terry. You have a great evening.
Okay, take care.
And that was director Terry Lone talking about The Last Rifleman. See it, see it, see it. Especially, many of you are off work today. Go find it in a theater right now. Sit down at home and watch it. In honor of the veterans, it's a wonderful film. An absolutely wonderful film. And, you know, as a point of reference, part of the research that Terry and writer Kevin Fitzpatrick did, they also watched a documentary called We Fought on D-Day. And it is a documentary that has extremely rare footage of the Northern Irish soldiers during World War II. And that helped to keep the whole Irish flavor of The Last Rifleman going. So, but now we're going to shift gears here. And, we're really shifting gears here. And we're bringing him back. Colin Cunningham is back with us. Hey, Colin.
Debbie, can you, first off, just a little bit of a sound check. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay. Pam, does he sound okay? She's nodding her head, yes.
Okay, because I'm sitting in the back of a bus.
Excuse
I'm not driving,
you?
I'm in the back.
Excuse
I'm literally
you?
Sitting, yeah, I know. And I'm sitting like right over the axle, and I've got a big coat over my head so I don't bother the other passengers. I'm so sorry.
Colin, you know, and Tim could have scheduled you for next week or even the week after.
No, I said, I want to talk to Debbie today. Waste no time. I don't care where I am. I was actually going to go into there's a bathroom on the bus, and I was going to go in there for 15, 20 minutes. And I thought, well, that's probably not a good idea in case somebody needs to go.
That's true. You're being considerate. You're being so considerate. But I am so happy to have you back on the show.
I'm happy too. Thank you.
It's been way too long, but you've been a busy little boy. And now, the last time you were here, we talked about Little Pink House.
That's right.
Now we're going to talk about He Never Left, which is nothing like Little Pink House.
Little different. Little on the different side.
But before we dive into He Never Left, I have to talk to you about one of my favorite films of the year, Horizon.
Oh, what's that? Oh, are you really?
One of my favorite films of the year. That
oh, my goodness.
Is the cinematography.
So, yeah.
Colin, watching that, I was spellbound, mesmerized. And
oh, wow.
I am dying for Chapter 2, which I know is done. I want all four chapters. I want to see Kevin get to make all four chapters.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been quite blessed in that I'm actually contracted to do all four. And look, I'm a little, you know, a little sad in that one did not do as well as that we'd hoped. And, you know, so I'm still crossing my fingers that we shoot 3 and 4.
Yeah.
2, I'm not sure when it's coming out or how, but, look, I thought it was a wonderful film too. No film is perfect. And, you know, and I just so support, you know, Kevin and the film. There's some just truly wonderful things in it, but I will say this, I had to laugh because the premiere that the day it opened was the same day as the Trump Biden debate. and that was like driving a white Bronco through your opening weekend.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it didn't help, but look, I'm so blessed and so pleased to be a part of it, and I'm still crossing my fingers that we do 3 and 4. I on a personal note, I can't see anything stopping Kevin. Kevin is he's a different kind of human being. Like
he
just vibrates at a different frequency, and he doesn't know the word failure. He's an amazing guy. He's kind of got that Tom Cruise thing. It's like he just doesn't know the word failure. It's like he was born without a synapse in his brain that would to where that word would ever make any sense to him. So he's an incredible human being. He's a visionary. And it was an honor beyond belief just to be invited to come on and play, you know. And, of course, my part gets bigger and bigger as we go along, so I'm just I'm still crossing my fingers that it comes to pass.
Well, I'm crossing fingers, toes, eyeballs, and anything else I can think of because it is one of my favorite films of the year. I have not been shy about shouting that since I screened it before it opened. I just love the storytelling, the visual storytelling, and the depth of the characters and the nuance of the lives that we're seeing unfold from the Old West. And it just, I wish people would appreciate things like this more, stories like this that are so filled with authenticity. Because I interviewed some of the artisans. I interviewed the costumer and a production designer. And everything is authentic. And that's Kevin. That's Kevin.
For sure. He surrounded himself with the best of the best. And it is. People forget or they never learn it. Sometimes it's just all about dates and history. But a lot of, like, people died. People were, they bought land that nobody owned because, you know, whether it be the military at the time or the government, it was native land and it was hostile territory and they didn't want to bother sending in soldiers to go to war. So instead we'll just send all these immigrants and have them tame the place. And it was brutal. There was no law. It was, you really had to look out for each other. And whether it be the pioneers, you know, settling every state from, I mean, I happen to live in Utah,
mm-hmm.
and they hold that history as quite sacred because people died and they died young and it was brutal, absolutely brutal. So they honor that. They honor the horizon that it's told through the point of view of many. It's not just. You know, it's the natives that were here and dealing with their own issues, and all of a sudden you've got this endless wave of new people coming in, and it's like, what do you do? You know, how do you manage? How do you do the right thing? How do you? It's they're difficult questions, and I commend, you know, Kevin. He's had this dream for just decades, and
I know.
And I think he's an incredible filmmaker, and he's an incredible man. And again, I was blessed to have taken part in it.
Well, I am dying for Chapter 2, and I so hope and want to see 3 and 4 get made as well, because it's truly an epic event in American history.
No, it absolutely is. It was also, I will say, historic in just how it was shot.
Yeah.
Because nobody's making movies like that anymore. If you want to do a Western epic, you go inside a big sound studio.
Yeah.
There's a roof on it, and it's all green screens and computers. When you were out there, what you see is what I saw when I was standing there. I mean, mm-hmm. there's, you know, 200, you know, cavalry, you know, cowboys and Indians and the town. And I mean, it was all really there. It was it was one hell of an experience. It really, really was.
I mean, this is a John Ford Western. That's how, you know, he made them out there in Monument Valley. And because I knew a lot of guys that worked on those films, many of whom have passed on now. But those filmmaking days, that kind of filmmaking, you just don't see anymore.
No, you just don't. So it was really nice to see. We all knew we were on something special, as in it was just like, they don't do this anymore, and God only knows when they'll do it again. And it's with, you know, the advent of AI and again computers and special effects, and but you could feel it, and when the wind blew, and there's a spirit out there that it's humbling, you know. It really is.
Well, and luckily we have more horizon to look forward to, since Kevin just got killed off of Yellowstone last night. What a death, let me tell you. But something else that is just like, talk about what a death. How about He Never Left and a new serial killer named Paleface?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Colin. I have never seen you in a role like this before. You were off the rails as Gabriel in He Never Left. Off the rails.
I so appreciate. Look, I so appreciate that. Thank you. I mean, look, as an actor, everybody loves to, you know, just loves to work. But sometimes that involves, you know, selling paper towels or automobiles during the commercial break. But every now and again, you get a part that you actually get it, and it's the kind of part that is the reason you got into the business or into acting to begin with. And what was interesting for me about this was that it was a Halloween slasher movie. But when I read through it, I just saw this character. And it was different. It was like, it really is more of a thriller than a Halloween movie.
It really is. Yeah,
I thought, oh my God, this character is incredible. He's a bad guy, and he's kind of in his own personal hell. And that's kind of what makes the movie a little different. You have characters that they're not cheerleaders that run out of gas and end up knocking on the door of Satan's house. Instead, they're people that are already kind of in their own personal hell, and they bring it to Satan's door in metaphorically in many ways, you know. So I just saw this this bad guy, but he's not too bad, but he accidentally, in many ways, he accidentally kills a kid, and he's got to hide out in a motel for 2-3 nights. And of course, you know, the motel has a history, and it has its own thing going on, but he can't call anybody. He can't tell anybody where he is. He can't let anybody see him, and he can't leave. And while he's there, he hears what he thinks is maybe a murder next door. But again, he can't call the police. He can't do anything about it. So what do you do? And I just saw, instead of it just being kind of a one note bad guy, I thought, I just saw these themes of redemption and atonement and the wages of sin, and yet we're going to kind of use this horror movie as a way for him to I don't want to say get better, but there's an arc, because he starts off paranoid, freaked out, totally bouncing off the walls
in a trunk,
and yeah exactly.
We meet Gabe in a trunk.
That's right. And yet, by the end of the movie, he's kind of a Zen monk. He's just there's nothing left of him, except for he's given a new path. And I don't want to give anything away,
no.
But there's a point in the movie where he does get out, and he can make the choice of he can hop in the car and go back to his old life, or do something different. And he makes a choice that's perhaps one of the first choices as a new human being.
Mm-hmm.
And his choice is it's one hell of a choice that he makes. But anyway, I just as an actor, you pray for stuff like this, because so often, again, you're selling paper towels or you're on a cop show or a doctor show. And for me as an actor, it was really, really nice to just kind of do a deep dive into a character that I could just sink my teeth into. So thank you.
I mean, it's just watching you. Number one, you're in a motel room, which is not big. It is small. It is very claustrophobic. We are feeling Gabriel's claustrophobia being trapped in this room. The way that you can only like peek out of the side of the curtain at the window. You don't want to go near the door. You don't even want to look out the peephole because, you know, for people that don't realize that, when you stand at a door and you look through the peephole in the door, the person on the other side can see it suddenly get dark and the light disappears. So, I mean, right. Poor Gabriel. And then he can't even use his cell phone because the reception is so bad. The only place to get reception, and these were actually some great comedic moments, dark comedic moments, when poor Gabriel has to go into the bathroom, climb up on top of the, you know, climbing the wall of the bathtub to have the phone up by the window so he can get reception.
No, the only place he can get reception is standing on top of the toilet.
I'm just watching that. And what I'm thinking is I'm watching because whenever you had to move, if you had to run to the door, you had to do this, you're leaping, you're climbing on the bed because there's nowhere to navigate. And when you think about filming, obviously you're not using the space, you can't navigate the space between the end of the bed and maybe a dresser or something, because obviously there's a camera there or there's lighting there. So your only avenue of movement is to be jumping back and forth on top of the bed as you go from the bathroom to the window, bathroom to the window, bathroom to the door.
Well, I'll tell you, it was certainly very challenging in terms of, just logistically and physically being there. It's like, how do we make this happen? Because we've got four walls. That's where you are for most of the film. But also story-wise, how do you put one person in a room and build tension?
Yeah.
It's a tricky thing to do because, you know, it can get boring after a while or you just kind of tune out. But instead, we hopefully came up with some, story points and things that happen chronologically that continue to build the tension, and that you're quite right. You're trapped in there with them. And it becomes what would you do? Because, you know, what does he do? I don't know. What would I do? I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the tension definitely does build, Colin. And, of course, I will admit, as you're running back and forth, hopping on the top of the bed. Now, when you're 5 years old, that works really well. When you're no longer 5 years old, I kept waiting for Gabriel to, like, fall, that his trajectory was off and he was going to fall into a face plant on the other side of the bed on the floor or whack his head on the door. But definitely, tension was building, and a lot of that also comes from some really great sound design.
Yeah.
James had some really great sound design happening here. So we have that muffled sound in the background. Almost at certain points, it's like you think that somebody's coming through the wall from room 9 into room 8, which is where
I have to give a shout out. James Morris came up with the original story, of course, with Michael Ballas, but I wanted to send a bar of gold to Michael Ballas. He's the other sort of the quieter of the two, but Michael's a genius. Michael was our camera operator. He was the film's cinematographer.
Editor.
He was the film's editor. He was the film's producer. He was the film's sound. I mean, you name it.
He did it.
Michael did all of that, and he took about at least 12 months to do. And if there was a particular, department in post, whether it be mixing or color timing or just all the different sound stuff, he would learn the program and then do the work.
Oh, wow.
Because we didn't have the budget to shop it out.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy blows me away, because look, we did this thing for like the price of a corn dog and a used Hyundai. And, you know, and that's kind of a weird thing to say, because look, the movie's either going to stand on its own or it won't. But it's quite the miracle what they pulled off. And even if they had, I mean, I've seen movies for $1 million, $5 million, $10 million, that, and I walk out going, well, that sucked, you know,
yeah.
But, you know, or that was great, but it was a movie, and they what they did with what they had, I just really think that these guys are something to be reckoned with. They're true talents, and I was just absolutely blessed to be given a shot as an actor to do something more than, you know, play the doctor or whatever. I mean, mm-hmm. it was complex. It was different. And it was different from your typical, say, slasher Halloween
yes.
movies. There was intelligence to it, and it did things that you don't normally see. It's not just the typical meat cleaver, and you know, somebody ran out of gas and now they're running for their lives. There was something more going on. So I'm just so happy that I got to, you know, bite my teeth into something like that.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, it definitely looks like a lot more than a corn dog and a used Hyundai. Money was spent on this. It looks good. Mike's cinematography, especially the night exteriors, look really nice. And it adds some depth and texture. So it doesn't look like a cheapo indie. There's low budget, no budget, micro budget indies. This might be a low budget, but it's got a great story with compelling characters. And I have to say, you actually do get to interact with a couple people. Not often, but a couple people. Gabe gets to interact. And one of them is with the motel manager, Bryce, played brilliantly by David E. McMahon. The two of you in that door scene, amazing. Amazing.
Well, it's so appreciated. David was absolutely amazing. And it's interesting, just the device or the concept of the lamp.
Yes.
James first had this idea of the lamp, and then we expanded it. But it's weird. It's, basically, there's a scene in the film, for anybody that hasn't yet seen it, where the manager gets word that a lamp broke. And he was like, you know, whatever happened, I broke a lamp, and like, yeah, sorry, and whatever, you know, like, get off the phone. And, but, because again, he's hiding out, and he's not supposed to be there. Somebody else is. His girlfriend, played by Jessica Staples, is the one who checks into the hotel and then sneaks Gabe in. But anyway, when this, she accidentally says to the manager that she broke a lamp, yeah, sorry, I couldn't get to the door. And so now he starts coming over to the room with a lamp. And of course, she's not in the room, but Gabe is. He can't be seen, and it's ridiculously comical, but it's also really tense because,
yeah.
And yet it's about a lamp. But again, we didn't have the money, and it was like, how do we build the tension? And it's like, you know, sometimes you break something in a room, but now the manager's coming over.
Yep.
He's knocking on the door. Gabe can't answer. So, of course, the manager's going to have to, he thinks there's somebody in trouble, the young girl in the room, and so he pulls through his keys. And so it was a wonderful scene to play with David, and it was again, just really interesting to see that in a script, because it's just little things like that you just don't often see.
And, of course, Mike's cinematography there, the camera blocking was so great, and the way he cut it so that we keep seeing Bryce's foot in the door. We keep going back to Bryce's foot in the door, and you are using every ounce of your shoulder or your splayed hands trying to shut that door on his foot, which was a very fat foot, really. So you weren't going to shut the door on the foot. But in panic situations, you don't think of those things.
Yeah, because Gabe's just like, yeah, no, because he's talking to him behind the door saying, yeah, no, we're fine. I don't need a lamp, you know. And then he goes to shut the door, and the manager, David, sticks his foot in the door.
Yep.
And it just things get... And then, of course, Gabe's phone rings, because that's his ride. And he's been told, under any circumstance, you must answer the phone when we call. So now it's ringing, in the bathroom, but he's got to deal with the manager and the lamp, and it's ridiculous, but it's also very real, very true, mm-hmm. and it was a delight to do.
And what's so funny is the entire time, Manager Bryce never lets go of that lamp. He keeps that in his right hand, no matter what. Doesn't set it down. He keeps holding on to that lamp. So these little things, just these little elements, add so much, Colin, to this. And then, of course, in the third act, you get an absolutely gobsmacking scene with Carla, who plays this character of Michelle.
Yeah, I don't want to give anything away, but again, it's sort of where the wages of sin, there's a high price to pay for this man. And again, look, he's not a sympathetic character. He's not somebody you would normally like. And he did, you know, accidentally or otherwise kill somebody mm-hmm. in a botched robbery. But he's certainly not as bad as the hell that he's in terms of this motel yeah. and the people that run it and the serial killer that's connected to it. So it's quite the scene.
Uh-oh, did we lose you?
Can you hear me?
Oh, there you are.
Hello?
There you are.
Nice. I'm sorry, I'm still in the bus.
I know you're still in the bus.
But I wanted to say it was something really, again, I have to commend James Morris and Michael Ballas for this, but there's a scene where Gabe is essentially, he's incapacitated mm-hmm. and he's been tied up and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And he comes to and he realizes that he's bound up. And in the script, he was supposed to get out of, you know, cut himself out, whatever. And then there was a fight that took place. But it was actually my suggestion. I said, James, and we're getting ready to do it. I said, just, I don't know, the whole getting out of the duct tape bit and then getting into a fight, like we've seen it. Every movie that anybody's ever been, you know, zip tied or duct taped, they always get out.
Yeah.
And it's kind of silly. And he said, well, so what do you suggest? I'm like, well, what if he doesn't get out of his restraints? And he's like, well, what would happen? And I'm like, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I have no idea what would happen. Why don't we just start shooting and we'll find out? And so that created that instead of Gabe getting out, because you're not going to get out. I mean, I don't want to think about these as real-life situations, but, I mean, you're not going to get out. If somebody's taking the time to tie you up, odds are it's gonna hold.
Yeah.
But it became this cat and mouse now because David now saw someone who couldn't get out. And so what does the cat do to the mouse when he knows the mouse is condemned is you play with it.
Yep.
You play with it. So it becomes this kind of cat and mouse thing and Gabe doesn't know what to do, but all that go again in camera, just intuitively kind of figured out and knew what to do with it. But yeah, the original scene was Gabe got out and then they have this big fight and
something happens.
But instead, I'm like, well, what if he doesn't?
Yeah.
You know, but again, these guys were so open to the creative process and story. It was like, well, what if I don't know what'll happen. Okay, great. Let's shoot that.
This definitely sounds like this has been one of your most creatively collaborative projects that you've worked on, working with James, working with Mike, and the input and the ideas free-flowing amongst the three of you.
There's no question about it. And like I said, it really is a gift because, look, I've been blessed. I mean, I really, really have. I did 5 years with Spielberg and I was on, you know, Stargate for on and off for 10 years mm-hmm. and Preacher and, you know, I've been really lucky to work on some wonderful shows. But often, you know, there's a lot of money involved. There's corporate involved. The suits are involved and you're not able to contribute or to experiment in ways because we just can't do it. Whereas with this, it really was. I really felt like I was part of a company because these guys, they didn't have any of those resources. But what they did have was a hunger to do something different, to make a movie, and to you know, sometimes you got to close your eyes and fall backwards and just have faith. But these guys burn to tell stories. They burn to make movies and to be in that kind of company. And to bring your game to it as a real contributor to it is it's just wonderful. It's just absolutely wonderful. So it's unless you're at the caliber of Denzel where you can do that at that level with that money. Mm-hmm. It's these small independent films that are just filled with heart and hunger, and you get to show up, and it's like, let's do this. You're the underdog, and there are no rules, and you can break rules, and it's like, what do we need to do to make this happen? And you just show up ready to play, and it's just such a delight.
You know, it's funny you say that because I just interviewed Kate Cobb on Friday. Her new film, Oki, is out. It's her first directorial, and here again, you know, low budget, no budget, micro budget, self-financing, and I ask her, you know, what if you had had more money? What would you have changed? She goes, no. She goes, she preferred not having more money because it made her become more creative in how she could fulfill the vision.
It's totally true. I mean, look, even when the shark doesn't work, right? The mechanical shark broke down. What are we going to do now? And that's where pure magic and creativity come from. It's when you don't have something that the real artist comes forward, because you've got to manifest it out of what you have, and you're forced to think differently. It's not paint by numbers. You've got to figure it out, and it's amazing.
Well, now with He Never Left out there for everybody to see now, it's on digital. I think it's still in some select theaters. What are you looking for in terms of a project at this stage of your career? Because you have always, you're consistently working. We don't go a long time without seeing you. Generally, we see you more on television than film, but you're always working. So I'm curious, what do you look for in a project? Other than a Kevin Costner saying, I want you, or a Steven Spielberg saying, yes, I want you. You don't have to audition. I want you. What do you look for when something comes your way?
Well, look, I'll say more of what I hope for. Because even if you look for it and you find it, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to cast you.
Mm-hmm.
So what I pray for, what I hope for, are characters that are engaging. It's not, you know, scripts that aren't stupid, stuff that's not cookie cutter, paint by number stuff. The stuff where you can just sink your teeth into it. It's less of a job and more of a craft, and you can contribute and take part in the process. And as an actor, so often when you have something to say or you have an idea, like, you're way down at the list. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, great, thank you. Whereas when you get a good part in a team, and your voice is heard, and I'm able to bring my toolkit and my passion for this thing called acting, and to really get in there and to take a deep dive and to be a part of something that hopefully will be good, because you never know in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also luck of the draw. You can have a great part and a great script, and even with a great director, and then when the movie comes out, it sucks. I mean, it's the luck of the draw. You just honestly don't know. You can't predict it, whether the budget's $100 million or whether it's $100. The $100 one may take off like a rocket, whereas the $100 million one didn't. So you honestly don't know. So you just keep showing up. If you're sitting around waiting for the big budget or for the big opportunity or for the TV show, you know, sometimes it'll be it'll be a little, the first film of some student filmmaker in some community college in Bakersfield, California. Mm-hmm. That could very well be the person that launches your career, or at the very least, if you're lucky, again, just as an actor, I can't control anything, but
yeah.
If I'm lucky, I'll be able to show up and play a character that means something, and a story that means something, that's got some redemption to it. You know, there's an arc of the character, and hopefully anybody that sees it will learn a little something about the character, or preferably about themselves, you know, just something that brings a bit of light for the world. There's so much darkness out there and so much crap, as you know.
Yep.
And so if I can make, you know, be a part of something, I don't even have to be the lead. I don't even have to be in it. I'll make sandwiches for you guys. But what you're doing is not typical crap coming out of Hollywood. It's not agenda. It's not propaganda. It's somebody trying to tell an authentic story. And God, we need more of that. You know that. I know that. And,
yep.
And so that's why, if anything, if I'm not going to be standing in front of the camera with some little no-budget movie in a motel somewhere, I'll help you make sandwiches. You know, I'll help you pull cable. I'll help take the garbage out, because these stories need to be told. You know, and these filmmakers need to be supported.
Well, you have done an amazing job with your performance as Gabriel here in He Never Left. I've never seen anything from you like this. It shows me extreme growth in you as an actor, that all those lessons you've learned with all the myriad of parts you've had over the years, you put everything in your personal toolbox. You brought everything into Gabriel. And I like the character. I actually like Gabriel, especially his freneticism, his panic, and then, as you said, his zen-like state. We see that arc. You take us on that ride with him, and we see him recognizing the error of his ways and his own internal redemption. Just job so well done, Colin. So well done.
Oh, I so appreciate it. I really do. Debbie, and hey, to whatever degree you can, if you can, I mean, right now I think it's Rotten Tomatoes. We're just, you know, looking to get the number, you know, it's actually doing pretty good. But I mean, if there's any kind of review or any positive comments you or any of your listeners can make, it's provided you like the film, naturally. I don't want anybody to lie, all right? But if there's some good things, yeah, that affected you in a way, any thumbs up is so welcome. And just thank you so much for, because it's not just me and it's not just Michael and James that. You're supporting.
It's everybody.
Yeah. It's an entire. It's a tribe. It's a team. There's a lot of artists and people out there that you support, and your voice is important. And just giving us the platform to, you know, to come out and say, hey, we're here. You know, and there's acknowledgement. It means something. So thank you.
Well, I actually am going to, because I am a Rotten Tomato approved critic, I am actually going to try and find some time, carve out some time to do a review on this one, because you're in it. If you weren't in it, I wouldn't. But because you're in it, come on, you should know, I'm very particular. Tim knows that. I'm very particular. But no, I'm going to try and find some time that I can get a review out on this one, because it is so well done. And your performance is just, it is something no one has seen from you before. And that that's just thrills me to see that.
That's so appreciated. Hey, Debbie, can I borrow $10? Because I'm a little short here.
I would loan you $10. I would loan you $10. There aren't too many people that I would loan $10, but I would loan you $10. You know, take it out in points on your next film.
There you go. There you go.
Well, my friend, don't be a stranger. Come back on the show more often. You don't have to wait for a film. You can come back whenever you want.
Well, I appreciate that. I'll tell you, I'd love to do an in-studio thing with you because I just love being around microphones and headphones. It's just so cool, you know?
Yeah, but do you love driving to Whittier?
Is that where you are? You're in Whittier?
Yeah, the studio's here in Whittier.
I love Whittier. Whittier's a wonderful place.
I've been driving here to Whittier every Monday for... Because I was coming down here even before I started my show 10 years ago. Do you know that wrapping up the in December, I'll wrap up the 10th year of Behind the Lens?
No way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
2020.
Hey, you know what? Look,
yes.
That's no joke, okay? And I'm glad that you mention it as a marker because... It's important. Sometimes, whatever it is that we do, we kind of lose focus and we lose track on it. It's like, well, it's whatever. It's like, no. You busted your ass for that. You've opened veins and you put in the hours. And when you first started out, you know, there's doubt and there's other people. Yeah, sure. Yeah, okay. Oh, is that what you're going to do? Oh, that's nice. And it takes courage and it takes labor and it just takes showing up. Dedicated. So I salute you and I congratulate you on your 10 years.
Well, thanks. But it takes people like you who will come on to the show. You know?
Well, I'm in your back pocket. You give me a call anytime.
Don't think I won't. All right, I'm going to let you go and finish enjoying your bus trip and get your coat off of your head so you can breathe. And hopefully we're going to talk sooner rather than later while everybody actually sits down at home or goes to the theater, but they can sit at home in the darkness and watch He Never Left. And then they'll be scared to death.
Well, and be scared to death, but you'll also maybe hopefully have taken a bit of a journey.
Yes.
Because it's not your typical, you know, stab and grab. Kind
no.
of movie. There's some depth to it, and I hope that. But yeah, it's a good popcorn movie, but it's also something you might ponder after you've seen it.
And yeah,
thank you so very very much for your time.
Thank
I really
you
do appreciate it.
So much, Colin. And yes, we must talk sooner rather than later.
Sounds good. All right. Be well, and thank you.
You too, and have a good bus trip.
Thank you very much. Talk soon.
Bye, Colin.
Bye, Cubby. Bye.
And that was Colin Cunningham talking about He Never Left. And let me tell you, people, when you watch the film, you got to watch through the credits because you keep getting peppered with things through the credits. And they're very important things. So that is all the time we have today. And then some, of course. Check out The Last Rifleman. Absolutely exquisite film in theaters, digital VOD, Veterans Day, and also, you know, you want to be scared, you want some blood, you want a good psychological look at a character, check out He Never Left. So, until next week, I have no clue who's going to be here next week. I'm waiting for confirmation from Annie, who's waiting for confirmation from talent, but we'll have somebody for you and lots of pre-recorded interviews. So until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.